Welcome to Whose Tactical RPG Is It Anyways, where the political allegiances are made up and the kudos just don't matter. That's right, kudos. They're just handed out for utilizing the high ground.
It is time to figure out what to have for supper.
But I just can't decide. Can't you pick?
Nope, you know how this is chosen.
Scales of conviction.
How to tell you're in a high-stakes political RPG.
None of the place names make any sense.
Do you guys know why everyone in Norzelia is still angry about the war 30 years ago?
Because war sucks.
Is it because war never changes?
Or is it because of the huge global conflict that could undo an economic system based around slavery and make an entire nation question its political and religious beliefs because of a lie that has been perpetuated by systemic oppression for the past 100 years to maintain a monopoly on an important resource?
It's because they're salty. And now I feel bad about joking about it. Thanks.
Some no one settled games were gonna be this way. Backlog's a joke, a choke, gamer cards at my hay. It's like you always play 2 years behind. When you really need a boost to heart, to health, or even your mind, no, Cal'll be there for you.
She'll say games that are so.
Matt'll be there for you.
Stuff.
We'll be there for you.
Cause we've all been there too.
Hello and welcome to RPG Backtrack, your regular deep dive into your favorite RPGs. We are a production of RPGamer.com, bringing you such fine podcasts like RPG Cast, your weekly RPG news show, Q&A Quest, your weekly RPG feedback show, and us, RPG Backtrack, your bi-weekly nostalgia show. I am your host, Kelly Ryan, and with me, as always, my podcast partner in crime, the Serenoa to my Frederica, Mr. Matt Basem.
So, wait a minute, we're not discussing quadrilateral-based action RPGs tonight?
I don't think so. I think we're just discussing tri-cornered strategy role playing.
Only got three sides tonight, Matt. Only three sides.
Oh, man. I added an extra side and didn't plan it at all. I just smashed the A button. I've messed this whole thing up.
We're not playing Rock, Paper, Lizard, Spock. That's
I always win.
No, we are covering triangle strategy. Probably the dumbest named game I've played in a while. That's one of the best games I've ever played.
It's the Bravely Default people. That's the thing. They make good games, but they can't name them. You know, what you gonna do?
I mean, if nothing else, they are nothing if not simple.
What you're saying is they're like the Ryan of video game creations.
Yes.
There's a lot of them. They're all very good, and there should be a club about them.
Yes. Well, one of the Ryans is here, Ryan Costa.
We do.
We all know that the best action's in three ways.
Whoa!
Kinky.
Wow! We told you to come up with something funny. You swung for the fences.
We also have a Josh Carpenter.
Hi.
And hailing from Q&A Quest, a Michael Wheels Apps.
Is the triangle the final shape? Does this game tie into Destiny?
Not tonight, Wheels.
It might tie into your Destiny.
Oh.
I do wish Peter Dinklage voiced someone in this, though. That'd be great.
Oh, his voice isn't even in Destiny anymore.
I know.
A whole lot of cartoon voices in this game, though. I recognize some people and other people I had to look up. But regardless, triangle strategy. I really like this game, guys. I think this was the evolution that strategy RPGs have needed since Ogre Battle.
It's been a while since we've had kind of like a new, kind of unique, fresh take on strategy RPGs. We've been, you know, the ones that we still get continually, it's stuff like Disgaea, where we're, you know, on our sixth or seventh entry.
Let's see, we have crazy stuff like Disgaea that broke the mold by being more comedy than political intrigue. I've obviously got your ogre battles and your ogre battle clones. Like, gosh, we should do a mercenary saga backtrack at some point. Get into all of those. And this one just kind of took everything good about a lot of those and made one great game.
So far.
As of this recording, I don't know if we're going to get a sequel or not. I am very curious.
Hexahedron strategy.
Ooh. You're doubling up there, man.
That could be interesting or scary. I tell you what, why don't we have a musical interlude with music from the game, and then when we come back, we're just going to go right into it, talk about all the great stuff about this game.
Sounds good.
And welcome back to RPG Backtrack, where we are talking about Project Triangle Strategy, which I just slipped up and said that it's its prototype name because I was thinking about the Nintendo Direct where it was announced. Originally released on March 4th, 2022, and then later on Windows that same year on October 13th. And yeah, this was announced in a Nintendo Direct that was in 2021. And it was originally called Project Triangle Strategy, and that was the supposed code name. And then later on, when we got more trailers, they just named it that. And even then, back then, I was like, well, thank God that that's just a regular placeholder name.
Nope. Coming up with names is hard, so we just decided not to.
No, I don't blame them. I have trouble naming things myself, so it makes sense. Called Triangle Strategy because of the rock, paper, scissors mechanics. And the other interesting thing about that, so it was announced on a Nintendo Direct on February 17th, 2021, so about a year and some change before it was released. And they put out a demo that day and said that they were taking feedback for that demo for the development of the game, which is kind of interesting. And according to the Wikipedia article, because of that demo, they added additional difficulty modes, alternate camera controls, and the ability to review past character dialogue, as well as tweaks to improving graphics and loading times. So kind of interesting stuff. And they've been doing a lot of that with these 2D HD games, because I think they did some of it with Octopath as well. And yeah, this was Squeenix's second 2D HD game using that engine.
Yeah, I remember playing the demo and just being like super hyped, just even after playing the same, like one or two maps that they gave you. It was just like, oh, this is what I've been waiting for.
So what was that demo like? Obviously it was a slice of the game very early in development from what it looked like.
If I recall, wasn't it the map that was on the bridge? I think you fought that.
Yes, it was.
I can't remember if there was a second one or not. So you got a little bit of a sense of like how height played into the battle system. And just that little bit was just enough to kind of like really whet my appetite for it.
Yeah, that's an element that I feel like has been missing in way too many strategy RPGs, especially a lot of indie games. Just like kind of just get these generic maps that where the environment doesn't really factor in that much.
Even if they have elevation, it doesn't really play into the battle system.
No,
whereas it's like here, there. You know, like like the old Tactics Ogre and such, like high ground really mattered. You know, the archers get better range, they do more damage, and it's just like if you were in any of those old games, like if you were down on the lower area and you had to fight your way up a hill, it was a brutal battle. Because the enemy just had a huge advantage over you. And a lot of game, you know, lots of tactical RPGs just just don't incorporate that in the same way those did.
No, and this one really, really does.
Yeah, they emphasize the terrain a lot in this game, because not just the elevation, but you could light grass on fire, you could freeze a lake to make it easier to get across. If units were in water, you could electrify the water and make it dangerous to go through. You could just set up ice blocks to block units. You really had to pay attention to your environment in this game in order to know what you were doing. And so many maps in this played into that hard. One of the story maps in particular, where the whole point was to set buildings on fire to basically trap enemies.
Well, debatably, that's what it was for, because you were supposed to not do that for certain aspects of the game.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit later, but for me, this strategy RPG was a breath of fresh air, because I'd been kind of burned out on Disgaea. I tried to play the Mercenaries games and just couldn't really get into them, because I mean, like we've joked that they were kind of Kmart versions of Tactics, which is fine.
Well, in fairness to the poor Mercenary games, I mean, they were supposed to be like small 20-hour games. I think they were originally on mobile and then eventually kind of came over to 3DS and console. Yeah. Like they were supposed to be kind of a smaller, more, you know, streamlined experience.
Yeah. I can forgive those. But there's like so many indie strategy games these days, and I just feel like they're all just missing something. And often not even the same thing. Like, this one's missing this one's missing that. I can't get into them. And as far as, like, like big publishers doing strategy RPGs, it's more been in, like, XCOM-y type, like the Mario and Rabbids games and Persona 5 Tactica. So this game was really, really refreshing, because it's... Other than like the Tactics Ogre
remakes, yeah,
the second Tactics Ogre remake, there hasn't been much like this in a long time.
And go ahead.
One of the interesting things I found about the conversation so far is how much breath of fresh air the game's been bringing in, and for me anyway, the combat outside of. Like, we've already mentioned the elements. That was very interesting. To play around with. Each of the characters having their own, basically being their own class and being useful in their own ways. I've talked to people where my favorite character I used the most was someone they found useless. I would consider a breath of fresh air. But the actual combat itself at times, there was moments where to be able to continue on, you have to go do random combat. And this, it isn't really random, though. The training levels are the same thing. And I just remember the training levels being, like, if they had a little bit more variety, I would have nothing to remotely grumble about. And I come from the era of tactical RPGs with, like, Final Fantasy Tactics, where you go to a map and they change up what you fight, where they're positioned, things like that. And it just seems like such a small thing they could have added with all this other stuff that they had in the game. And it just felt like that was the same thing over and over, unless, like, the story missions, of course, entirely different. Story missions are some of the best I've ever played in a tactical game. But it's a genre that tends to lean towards grinding, and that felt a little lacking to me at times.
I did not find the need for those maps until, like, the last few battles of the game, to be honest. But I see what you're saying, for sure.
I played those maps just for completion's sake, but aside from trying to get some money and maybe some materials to upgrade my weapons, I found that I didn't have to grind nearly as much as I would in a Tactics or a Disgaea type game.
Well, Disgaea is completely built around grinding.
Yeah.
So, but
yeah.
To be fair, I happened to wanted to try out every character, which is why the grinding came in. It's not that I needed it to finish fighting story missions. It was mostly like, oh, I'm at this story mission. I have 10 level 20s, but, you know, 10 of them are woefully underleveled. So I would take that team to go through and level them up, which means I was doing those missions. So I didn't have to have a, you know, group A, group B situation, but because I wanted to see how each individual character leveled and played as they leveled, it meant that I redid more than I needed to. So I admit that aspect.
And some of it is just like what level of difficulty you want to play on, because you can at least adjust it here. So if you want to, you know, if you don't want to have to do as much grinding, you can just kind of like dial back the difficulty. It's not quite as necessary. It's always really hard in tactical games to figure out how you're going to, you know, completely fill out the game. Are you really going to just go with like 20 set story maps? Are you going to try and reuse them? Are you going to have like these, you know, just separate side battles that are optional that people can do? And then how do you incorporate that back in? And very few games like get that really well done and right.
And bear in mind, I played on easy and I still felt pretty challenged, like playing through the game wasn't, at least the first time through, didn't feel like a cakewalk. I felt challenged pretty much the whole game. But particularly some of those later maps where you start the map at a huge disadvantage, like in a valley or on the other side of a bridge or whatnot.
Or and, with bombs or, threatening or with to bombs. Explode.
Oh, God. we'll get to that one. And it really kept my thinking hat ticking throughout the rest of through the entire game. I did not feel bored. I did not feel like I was just going through the motions. It was just like Final Fantasy Tactics way back when, where I felt challenged and I appreciated that while still having it be on easy so that I'm not getting like completely, you know, stomped. That I could still, if I got stuck, like in the case of the bomb map, I could always restart it or try it again or save at a point. Because I'm pretty sure you could save in the middle of some maps.
Yes. You could use that a lot.
Yeah. Save where I thought that, like, okay, I'm going to try this and see if it works. If not, I'll go back to previous save. That's what I thought about this game was so great.
One other thing I loved about the combat was that magic users weren't just like paper tissue thin like they are in so many strategy games. You know, if you let the enemy get to your magic users, they're just like dead in one hit practically. Mm-hmm. In this game, like they had a little bit of heft to them, so you didn't have to just constantly be defensive and make sure, like, oh goodness, like I got to make sure that the enemy can't get to my mage back here. Like no, you could they could take a hit or two, and it kind of opened up the gameplay. Like I don't know, I'm usually very cautious about just like turtling and trying to make sure that I'm defending all of my weaker units, and you could you know, like be a little bit more freelancing in terms of how you wanted to do your strategies in this one and not just get totally hosed.
Yeah. I really like the MP system too. Like you never had to worry that, oh, you know, your magic users are going to run out of magic and then they're just going to be useless. You know, you just have to essentially make them defend a few turns, get some more points, and then they can cast magic again.
I think that removing magic points and giving this game an action point system is the best thing a strategy game has done in the past years.
Totally agree.
Because I hate it in strategy games when all of my mages and healers run out of MP and they're pretty much useless from that point on. And it really makes you have to think, like, okay, should I just nuke these guys right out of the gate, or should I wait a couple of turns and then wait for my more powerful AoE spells to be available so that I can start going nuclear? You know, it's that risk and reward system that I think is so great in games like this.
Oh, it even plays into, we were mentioning the elements, because if you want to use a stronger ability to, say, electrify the water, you can use a turn with another character to make the water and then have the shaman start making it rain and things like that. So even it all ties into each of the characters playing off of each other and being useful in ways that you don't necessarily expect.
There's a lot of classes in this game that aren't necessarily combat classes that were still just as useful as the combat classes because of the stuff that they could do, like give your guys a buff or give you guys an extra turn or an extra action point.
Build a ladder.
Yeah. Yes, build a ladder.
That is so useful in a couple of maps.
Yeah. Getting a new character in this game is incredibly exciting because it's not just like some random new schlub that can take some damage. It's, well, what cool new abilities or spells might this character have that are going to give me more options in battle? It's great.
And something else great about this game that I appreciate. Do you guys have the problem in strategy games where you agonize over stuff like gear, optimize it? Well, Unicorn Overlord had this problem this year where you could all gear them and you're like, do my guys have the best gear that they could possibly equip? What about these accessories? I'm just going to let the computer handle this and optimize everything. In this game, everybody has one weapon that gets upgraded throughout the course of the game. Mm-hmm. There's a skill tree that you can play around with that has set skills and a couple of skills that you can choose either or and swap out at any time. And just taking that stress out of a strategy game was a game changer. And I know we had some people on RPGcast complaining that they didn't like that what they like about strategy games is the micromanaging, and that's perfectly fine. But as I get older, it's like I just want to equip what the computer says I should equip and go hit things.
Yeah, and I feel like that gives you puts the focus of this game on the actual strategy of like each battle. Like you don't have to sit there spending hours worrying about the perfect makeup of your party. Most of your time is actually in battles, trying to figure out how to win battles. And it seems novel to say that about a strategy RPG, but I think there's too many where you just spend too much time, messing around with character stats and whatnot, and not
spending
enough
time in menus. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
If I want to agonize about stats, I'll go play Diablo because that's one character to deal with. Dealing with the whole army, it just, at this point in my life, it overwhelms me.
And for me, I'm a fan of tactical RPGs in all forms. I'm also a loot fiend. I love loot overall. Now, there are two different ways that when it comes down to it to look at a tactical game. One is managing and customizing each character individually. The other one is using the strategy of this is what you have, work with it. And that using bigger game examples, it's the Final Fantasy Tactics versus the XCOM. XCOM, there isn't really that much gear to deal with. You just make your characters, but you have to pick positions and everything. Every choice matters. And triangle strategy is more accessible, still difficult, but not that difficult version like the XCOM type. Because if we were mentioning how mages usually go down one or two hits, well, in triangle strategy, if you don't have a shield, any of those characters are going down in one or two hits. So
that's true.
Instead of making a specific class squishy, they make everyone, it's more realistic to how combat would work. And same kind of way, we were talking about MP system. If you have something where you just need to charge up, so to speak, because you have your ability points, then it means what you do and how you do it matters more. Because if you have no ability points, you're not going to have that character stand up front and take all the hits. Mm-hmm. It's just, and with the sheer variety of characters, too, if they gave us a gear system as well, it would take away from the joy of it, so to speak. Because, like, as it is, there's probably some purists that would say this, boiling it down to, this would just be, like, why have the HP total so high? Why not just say, fire does one damage type thing? And at least we do have that aspect where it still makes it accessible. We all know our HP totals. You don't have if you do this, it equals that. You have tactics to play around with. The damage done can differ based off of what people are standing on. If brush is lit on fire, or they're on a dry land, they take more damage from fire or lightning attacks. Like, it's just... The micromanaging is done on a level that isn't really noticeable by players necessarily, but it's still like, if you look into it, there's a lot of nuance to every system in the game.
And I'm looking right now, apparently there are 30 characters to recruit over the course of the game, and most of them dependent on which routes you take.
So the only real sad thing I had to playing one route is I didn't get to see some of the characters and how they interacted combat-wise.
So do you want to talk about the routes? Are we done with sort of the gameplay? Because I think we covered just about everything with the gameplay. Good segue to the kind of the story itself, because, yeah, the other big thing that was advertised with this game is that you're going to have choices. And unlike our fellow co-worker Sam's quote-unquote favorite choices, like save the baby, eat the baby, these are hard, like, but rock in a hard place kind of choices.
Do still have a few choices that end up being like a choose your own adventure, where it's like, do you go left or do you decide to stay and eat food? Like, okay, you stay and eat food. Well, now you're eating a baby. Like, wait, what?
Like, the first area of the game, or the first choice of the game, where you pick who you escort back to their home territory, Roland or Frederica, is kind of like easing you into the system. And at most, your big decision there is, well, would you rather have the archer or the frost mage? But then later on, the choices get very tough.
Well, and it's not just a choice, of course. It's the scales of conviction. So you have to, like, actually manipulate your party. Yeah. You have to manipulate your party into whatever choice you want them to make. And you can lose those. I don't know how many of you guys did. Maybe you were better at it than I was. I mean, there were several of them where I wanted one decision, and like either the decisions and, you know, it's based also upon what did they call it in the game?
It was three different moralities, and I believe it was liberty, morality, and conviction.
Correct. Yeah. So it would be based upon that, and then also that would affect your ability to actually convince different characters to change their votes to different ways. So they'd tell you up front, like, okay, here's how everyone's thinking right now, and you could go around and talk to them and try to... Sometimes you could, like, wander. You had those weird sections where you could actually explore in a strategy RPG. Usually it would be of the map you were about to fight, so you kind of get, like, a preview of the map that you were about to actually fight on. You could go and talk to people, pick up little tidbits of information, and maybe you could use that to kind of, like, convince one person to vote one way or the other. It was, like, a really weird and interesting and different system for you know, not just like a straight binary choice, like no, you got to manipulate people to get them to go the way you want.
And for as someone who loves dialogue in games to the point where even a game this robust, I wanted more conversations, it gives a reason to go talk to everybody other than just being curious for what new dialogue's there. It's you're learning little bits about the characters and sometimes how to manipulate them, because you'll learn inside the town, you know, this group that's expected to show up is going to be late, but your party doesn't know that. So they're like, oh, we're going to wait for reinforcements. No, they're going to be late. Oh, crap. And then that sways them to the decision you want to do, or you don't tell them that, and it sways towards being more rash than waiting. And it changes the battle that comes up as well.
I'm just kind of looking through some of the different choices here. The second major decision in Chapter 7 is whether or not you're going to turn over Prince Roland, who is your... Let me back that up with the story. That there's three major nations in this game. One of them is Whiteholm Castle, where It's kind of one of the major political parties, and it's where your betrothed is from. I'm trying to find the others. Sorry, I'm looking at a strategy guide right now, if you can't tell. Because I was trying to find the different paths and stuff.
We have the Holy State of Hyzant, the Grand Duchy of Asfrost, and the Kingdom of Glenbrook.
Thank you. So the Holy State's kind of a religious area, and that they're famous for being able to mine salt, while the Asfrost area is more of a kingdom and famous for being able to mine iron. And then you have the middle one. What did you say?
Glenbrook.
Glenbrook. You have the middle one, Glenbrook, and that's where the prince is from. Prince. And then there's Saranoa, who's in the Wolfhard house, who's kind of in the middle of all of this. And his dad is in a coma, so the game starts with him kind of taking over, being the decision maker with everything.
He has to learn the ropes of the politics before the dad goes in the coma, though, so he's not in charge right from the beginning.
True. So the game starts out with one of the mines making this huge discovery, and some high political figure getting murdered in the mine, whose name is escaping me at the moment.
Starts with a D. I'll have to look it up.
Yeah,
but basically one side thinks that the other side deliberately assassinated this person, so war is about to break out. And you're in the middle of it, and also you're marrying one of the princesses of Arfrost. Did I say that right?
Asfrost.
It's kind of a political marriage to basically strengthen both of those houses. And that particular woman, Frederica, was the illegitimate daughter of the lord of that place and a Rosellian.
Yeah.
I believe that's what they're called. And Rosellians are a slave, a race of slaves that work for the Holy Empire.
Right.
So she's very kind of shit on by her siblings and society as a whole, because these Rosellians have pink hair, and she's born with pink hair while the siblings have white hair, so they think very low of her. And I am blanking on the guy's name, the main character.
Saranoa,
thank you. he kind of takes it in stride, and I don't know about you guys, but I sort of was doing everything I could to make Frederica happy in my playthrough, just because I felt so bad for her.
Mine started with the first choice. You mentioned that it was it led you to one character or the other. I happened to play the game for review, so that means I didn't look at any information beforehand. So I ended up going to the Grand Duchy with all the salt, not where she's from, just because she was treated poorly by her relatives. Why would I take her back there? So I'm going to show her the world.
That ended up being my first route too, and I don't even remember why I picked that route. I think it was because I wanted to learn more about Roland, who I thought was kind of an interesting character at the time. Also kind of a beast of a character with his lance. My Roland got pretty powerful by the end.
But once you go to Hyzant, you see how the Rosellians are treated. I mean, it's not just that they are slaves. They are just like treated like scum of the earth. It is horrific depiction in a video game.
Yeah, it was definitely giving me real life vibes of various slave classes in history. I'm not going to name them specifically, but you can kind of guess, especially with the religious implications of the empire itself. That made me kind of uncomfortable.
I'm just surprised that this seems to have been going on for generations, and like, salt still only found in one area that's mined by slaves. Like, there was never they do have Frederica's mother tried leading a revolt, but it seems like the rest of the world was like, yeah, that happened 20 years ago, but we don't want to talk about it.
And getting into spoilers a little bit, but the whole crux of the game is about them finding a salt deposit in that mine, and the guy from Glenbrook, or no, sorry, Gustadolf accused Glenbrook of murdering Dragan, and Dragan is Gustavolf's cousin.
Yeah, but he set the whole thing up.
Exactly.
basically, the whole thing was set up. Yeah. And the whole empire basically wants to maintain its monopoly on salt production because it has made them a very powerful and very rich nation. But also, the disparity between the high class and the low class is pretty high, too. But then there's also that place is also famous for its medicine, which is kind of an interesting topic. Basically, the whole game is just very politically charged, but in a way that, for me at least, wasn't confusing, or definitely not as confusing as, say, Final Fantasy Tactics was. I had no idea what was going on for the majority of that game.
No, this game really gives you a good sense of the world, what's going on, you know, the state of the different nations, state of the people. You really get a good feel for exactly, you know, what the world is, and that makes it all the more interesting when it all starts to go to hell.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
If I had one minor complaint, it's that with each route being so vastly different, even individual choices will boil down to sometimes characters going, I'm your best friend, you'll completely agree with me, we are really close. I choose against you. Well, now you're my enemy, I'm killing you. Wait, what? Like, it just seemed very... They were able to flip from an entire 180 on a dime. And it fits within the story, but if you play it through a second time or redo a choice and see what happens the other way, it kind of felt like sometimes characters didn't have a through line, where it's like this character is known for doing this, which is something from Final Fantasy Tactics that I didn't like. You knew these characters were going to play out like the like how they are, rather than like depending on your playthrough. A big example of that's your advisor Benedict. He can be a very different person in all three playthroughs.
Mm-hmm. And jumping ahead just a little bit, that I find interesting is that in the last major choice of the game, no matter what, well, at least my first playthrough, because unless you're following a guide, you're not going to find that fourth route. You just aren't. Game doesn't telegraph it at all. But you've got your three choices, and inevitably, no matter what you pick, you're going to end up pissing someone off. And in my playthrough, it ended up being Benedict, because I chose to try to free Frederica's people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, it's going to sound weird, but I kind of prefer that nice, neat, happy ending be harder to find and not clear, because I think the messier endings make more sense.
The world is messy. It definitely fits. The story as you're going along is just very much like filled with two bad options, and you try and pick the least bad of your options.
Like, I believe one of them is one of the people in the church is blackmailing you into either you give me support or I'm going to do something bad. I think you have to pick between turning him in or getting his support. Mm-hmm. And at that point in the game, you kind of need his support.
And that is one of the things I appreciated with Sarah Noah, is going off of what we were saying, everything boils down to the choices that are made. Like, part of it's with the majority, but ultimately it's that main character deciding, am I going to turn these people into picking my choice or not? And through those flawed choices, there is no neat ending. If you make something like in early in chapter two, you turn in that person, you get your hands dirty in a particular way, it shouldn't just be all clean at the end.
And like I said, my choices were less politically motivated and more siding with my wife.
Same. And even though I went her full route in that ending, like, broke me.
Yeah.
Because I was honestly expecting it to have a nice, neat, happy ending, and then it didn't. And it was just like, oof. Although I appreciate that they had the conviction to do that.
Yeah. Doesn't she end up shaving her head and becoming a kind of a street preacher for trying to liberate her people?
No, I think that's a different ending.
Okay. That might be what happens when you make her upset because you back Benedict.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, if you take her route and liberate the Rosalians, you lead them to their homeland, and Serenoa dies protecting them.
Oh,
on the way okay. there.
Yeah, on the way there. Yeah, and
he doesn't get to live happily ever after.
Yes, and it teases it almost like, oh, he's gonna come back, and then he just doesn't, and it just kind of leaves you with this empty feeling going into the credits. It's great. I love that they had the conviction not to just like, oh, okay, he's fine. Everyone's happy.
That's interesting because I did get that ending. I remember now. And yeah, I feel like on the one hand, it's kind of sad of him dying. But on the other hand, my people were free. And I was kind of okay with that. But then I was also interested in getting the ending where everybody's happy. And to do that, you have to go through, you have to pick a very specific route and go through have a very specific set of flags that you make sure that you do or don't do. And that last choice, you have to, I think you have to like either cancel out of something or find a hidden option in the menu that says there has to be another way.
I think it's like they keep saying you have to make a choice and you have to say no like four times before the option shows up or something.
Yeah, it's something insane like that.
Yeah,
that's good. Make people pick a messy ending.
So some of the things that you have to remember not to do. There's one mission where all of the characters figure out that there's this oil in the house in these houses,
oh, yeah, and that you have to not burn any of the houses. Yeah.
That was so hard.
It's in chapter 7. That's like the first really brutal battle you're fighting against. What is it, General Avlorla of the
God of Laura, as far as I'm concerned, and just wipes out everybody.
Insane without burning down the houses. How do you do that?
I had to do one.
New game plus where you're OP is how I've beat that fight without burning any houses.
Yeah, I think that's the only way I would attempt that. Going for that ending would be like new game plus or just playing through and bumping the difficulty all the way down.
Love that battle, but I mean, it's a brutally difficult battle where you're trying to lure her around to kind of get near one of those houses and then like, oh, awesome. I can like spring the trap, burn it. Because it's about the only way to really do a ton of damage to her.
I groaned so loudly when I found out that was the first choice that was needed. Luckily, every other choice I made was very far away from it, but I was like, if I had only not needed to set that one place on fire. Because the other ones involved going to Ace Frost, which was a place I avoided so much that I don't even think I had one side cutscene with the uncle, who's like the best character in the game, apparently. And I'm like, oh, I missed that guy entirely.
So then there's that. And then later on, you get a choice to flood a whole town, which is also you're not supposed to do, even though that's another incredibly hard fight.
Well, yeah, it makes the fight kind of like very easy if you do it that way.
I forgot, are there less units if you flood the town?
I think so, right? That's my memory.
I think so. I was just briefly remembering back because I talked to even NPCs, so that one house I burned down has like a mother and daughter sit in front of the wreckage the rest of the game and have different "why don't I have a house" conversations.
Game.
It's the funniest thing about this game is I played like the first battle or two and then talked about it on Q&A Quest and it was just like, oh, you know, this is like a lighter, you know, tactics ogre, not as serious story wise. And boy, did that game make me pay for Oof.
You should do Benedict's route just because of that. That statement.
The other funny thing, so I'm looking at the Golden Path requirements right now, you have an easier time if you surrender Roland, trying to get that requirement for not burning the houses. But then you have to sacrifice one of your better units at the very beginning of the game. So either you do a really hard fight that you might not win.
Sacrificing.
Yeah.
Roland wasn't even a top five character for me.
He ended up being pretty powerful for me.
That just relates to what I was saying, though, of like we could go through each of the characters and someone would say how they're terrible and someone else would say how they're amazing.
At that point in the game, I couldn't let Roland just, you know, I couldn't abandon him like that. Mm-hmm. Later on in the game, I might could have, but at that point, I definitely couldn't.
So who else made heavy use of the Invisible Girl?
Anna Pascal.
Yes.
Whose name I only remember because it's two of our staff members. I used her quite a bit.
Oh, yeah.
And me too, especially playing on hard. She was, like, invaluable.
Not only could she stealth really well, but she also had, like, a really good jumping range, too, so she could get on top of buildings and stuff. And when it comes to games like this, I always like characters that have better jump ability because of how many of them end up just completely useless on the ground in some of those harder maps that have houses and valleys and stuff.
And Anna was a character that was generally good the entire time, but I had won or lost fights more with Huet, the flying archer.
Yeah, I used her a lot too.
Like, there were a few maps where she was the only survivor. Like, the only reason I had to burn one building down in that Avlora fight is because Huet was on rooftops and no one could reach her. So she was just able to pick everything off and everyone else was dead.
Yeah, I think I had one fight where I had her, like, on a tower, right where the ladder went up to. So no one could actually climb up to there. And, like, there were no ranged characters left. So I just sat her up there and just picked everyone off slowly and eventually won that battle. It was one of the ones on a bridge. It's a few bridge battles that are pretty tough.
Yep.
It's funny because the flying archer character in Ogre Battle or in Tactics Ogre ended up being one of my most powerful characters in that one. And yeah, Huet was like invaluable for me for a lot of those fights because of how much elevation matters and being able to just have her pick at people.
Yeah, in the same respect, another character I found invaluable a lot was just the Frost Mage.
Yeah.
Because you could put up like a frost wall and just like funnel enemies in different ways.
I
had a damaging spell too, but I think I ended up using that frost wall like more than that, just like controlling where enemies were coming from.
Yeah, I used her. I used Frederica obviously for the fire stuff to be able to burn grass. I used that frost mage to make frost walls and freeze the ground and stuff like that. There was one mage that could do lightning that I used quite a bit. Yeah, Narv Oparin. It was either her or Narv. I might have swapped
Two. I used both of them, but because the shaman could actually create like change the weather as well. I used her more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she. The shaman has right of lightning, deal lightning type magic to an enemy to have a chance to paralyze them, or the wind damage that was an AoE, which was nice. You have Decibel, the robot in a barrel, which is kind of your joke character for this game. Your yogurt, if you were.
I don't think I got them.
I can't remember if I got them either.
I think, because I remember having it relatively balanced between all the morality, liberty, utility aspects. And I think a guy in the barrel and there's two other characters, unless you choose that route and pick everything that's morality, you're not going to get them because there's just not enough points in the game. You have to do New Game Plus to get it. Or it's really, really hard anyway, because like I don't recognize decimals listed as the morality. You need 1600 morality. There's also a character named, I was going to pronounce it Quahog, like a Quahog or something like that. And I don't recognize him from my party. He deals with time, apparently. Like, he's a time mage almost.
I may have heard him.
And Giovanna is a third character. And I'm like, I don't recognize them because I was in the middle of it all. So I didn't get high enough to get some of those characters.
I ended up using Lionel a lot just to get extra cash.
I mean, Lionel was good. I know people just use him for certain aspects, but he was one of my tanks. He just never died. And then you use Charm. It's great.
Plus, also, he could lower enemies' physical defense, which was nice to have in a pinch.
Mm-hmm.
And cause people to berserk, too, so that they wouldn't use their special abilities. And I liked his voice for some reason. He had a very jolly voice. But getting back to the Golden Path, so I had this up for my second playthrough. In Chapter 9, you need to choose to smuggle the salt. And then in Chapter 10 afterwards, reveal Roland's identity to Svog. And then in Chapter 11, you need to protect the Rosilian village. And then in Chapter 15, Part 1, you need to return to Wolfheart Castle to visit Lord Simon. I think there's also another bit that you have to do that isn't in this list, where you have to do an investigation to prove something in one chapter. You guys remember that chapter at all?
I didn't do the true ending, so no, I don't remember.
No.
So in one of the sub chapters, instead of having a choice with the scales of conviction, you had to basically go into the town and see if you could find enough evidence to prove the salt smuggling.
Oh yes, yes, yes! I remember doing that now.
Similar one later on where you have to try proving that you can join the Rosellians, something like that anyway that I remember. But yeah, it's difficult sometimes to get those choices because I remember it being hard to get all the evidence together.
Yeah, I definitely used a guide for that because I was so afraid I was going to mess it up. But talk about very ace attorney of them.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, I wish that they would have had more chapter choices like that, where how much you explored depended on, or rather, I got that in reverse. What happened next depended on how much you explored and tried to find stuff. So then, yeah, and the true ending pretty much, it makes everybody happy. You liberate the people of Roselia, you make Roland happy somehow, and you make Benedict happy. I'm being vague because I don't remember what the other two choices were that were going to piss off the other two characters.
Roland basically turns into Mr. Religious, and if you don't prove to him something that he has issues with on a religious matter, you can piss him off that way. Benedict is very, you have to make sure the house survives. So that was one of the things in Frederica's playthrough, is you had to burn your house down. And Benedict's like, no, you are not. I will not be a part of this. And that's why he leaves, because he doesn't want to see the ancestral home go up in flames. And yeah, it's just basically logic, religion, and heart is how I refer to it. I don't think that's how the game refers to it in any way, but it's similar to the choices for like utility, morality, and all that stuff.
And yeah, the other thing that I remember from that particular, from both of those paths, freeing the Rosellians and doing the true path, is that one fight where you're in the middle of the goddess statue that you're trying to break to prove that there's a pillar of salt in it. Yeah. And you're surrounded by water, and I won that fight just by lighting up the water with lightning the whole time and letting everybody get fried like a toaster in a tub.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this game is amazing. I love it. After that point.
Speaking of that fight specifically, that was, there are other moments where I said, wow, but that was the only time I can think of with the visuals that my breath was taken away. Because the way the reflection on the salt plays with the lighting is just like, this is 2D still? And I just took my breath away.
This game is gorgeous, by the way. It's Squeenix's second 2D HD game, and I'm so glad that they've utilized that engine for other games and remakes and stuff, because it looked like what I thought Final Fantasy Tactics looked like back in the day. It's so beautiful. so many bright and colorful sprites, and it makes the maps just gorgeous to look at while you're fighting in them, and while you're exploring in some of the towns and stuff, and talking to people and having your convictions raised. Just some of the unique stuff around the towns is pretty cool to look at. I played this on Switch, so the Steam version added achievements. And while I was looking what are the achievements was, find every cat in the game. I would have gotten that achievement had I been playing on Steam.
There were lots of kitties to pet.
Yes, and they make a little mew sound, and it's so cute. But I digress. And at some point, I need to go back and do the other paths, because while I was refreshing my memory today, watching videos that recap the story, I didn't know that one of the paths has the fight on a boat.
Yeah, like towards the ending, or like actual ending choices, because
I'm thinking of a
boat fight.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you which chapter it was. I just know that your units are on one boat, the other units are on another boat, and you're trying to get your boat to their boat so that you can smack them.
Right, and the one I was thinking of is the fight. It is still one. It is still a choice to get to that fight, but where you fight the brother and sister that have been pissing you off the whole game. Yeah. They're trying to escape on a boat, and you catch them at the harbor and fight them.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I did that one. I also know that there were some pretty terrible, as in difficult fights, where you're in a valley and the canyon is full of archers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, thank God I had Anna there and my hot girl there. Pick off those archers, because otherwise that fight would have been brutal.
So, I remember on some of those, just like, okay, I'm just going to pick one side and I'm just sending my party over there to get away from the rest of them. I'm just going to work my way around.
Oh, and then there's the fight in the arena. Do you guys remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
I used a lot of knockback moves in that particular fight because, yeah, it was a fight to the death where you could, if you knock people into the pits, you could have them hit traps and stuff. And I utilized that quite a bit.
One of the things I both appreciated and was frustrated by, where it means I have to do other playthroughs, is based on the choices you make, you might not get to fight some of the villains that you really wanted to see get their comeuppance. Like, it'll happen off screen. It'll be like, oh, the other half of the party that you didn't control took them out. Like, but no, I wanted the satisfaction.
Yeah, I saw that you could recruit the two bandits, Travis and Trish, later on in the game, and I don't think that, because I don't remember ever recruiting them.
I know I did that one because I really liked how Trish played, and she became one of my go-to party members for a bit. I don't remember Travis that much, though, like how he played anyway.
So were me and Ryan the only two people that did the true path?
I did not do the true path. I knew it existed after.
Oh, okay.
You may have been the only one who did it, Cal.
Yeah. Huh. I read all the story size, which is why I know, like, no one in their right mind would have done it, but Benedict's story, oh boy. Some twists and turns happen in that one for sure.
Well, because there was kind of a mind fuck at the end of the true path that now I don't even know if I want to say, because I'm the only one that.
Go ahead.
But basically, the holy religious person that's been in charge the whole time was a robot, a mechanical doll, and
I kind of figured.
Yeah, and I can't remember what else came of that. It seemed like, oh, we got all three story points. Now we need to have one big bad. Here's a religious big bad out of nowhere. The end is what it kind of felt like. And I'm sorry if it's not actually like that. It has been 2 years since I played this game, so I don't remember the exact details. But yeah, finding out that the holy leader was a robot was kind of like, damn, you guys went there. But still made it worth it to do the golden path just to make everybody happy.
Was it like a robot, or was it like a Wizard of the Oz thing with someone just controlling someone behind the curtain controlling a thing?
I think it was
someone controlling, but yeah. I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact story details, unfortunately. I had refreshed my memory on the on the story earlier today, just using recap videos. So I was doing that during work today, so I was a little bit preoccupied. But it was still a pretty good story, though, with lots of twists and turns and stuff to make you question your own morals. And
there were a ton of twists and turns, you know, like all three of the countries, they all had their own political intrigue and backstabbing people and that you would have to ally yourself with, and you know, like you're maneuvering your way through back and forth, like, okay, do I want to try and team up with this slime ball? He seems like a slime ball who's going to sell me out, but I don't have a whole lot of other choices, so I guess I'll team up with him.
With how many twists and turns there were, it makes the instances where things are so straightforward that much more endearing to me. And by that, I mean House Wolfert is one of three main houses in the Kingdom of Glenbrook. There are two other big houses. And no matter what routes you pick, they always do something stupid and die off in like 2 minutes. I love that because it's like, okay, well, if I go this route, you know, the guy who's like, I love everyone, Glenbrook, I will join no matter what. Like, okay, the route I went because you don't turn in Roland. He's like, I'm going to defend this country till the end. And then if you go there, if you go turn against Glenbrook, he just kind of goes, well, you're going to have to kill me now. And like, either way, he just dies. Like, there's no happy ending for that guy. The other guy is always going to be a slime ball. No matter what choice you make, he always betrays your conviction, and then you fight him later on. Like, it's just so refreshingly simple in a game where every choice you make has so many different ways of things turning out and twists and turns, to have something so simple at the beginning like that, because it throws you off. You don't expect just how deep the rabbit hole goes.
And yet, for a game full of political intrigue, I was never bored, not once. And that's unusual for me with deeply political strategy RPGs like this. I feel like they get, they just get so deep into politics that I can't be bothered to want to learn all about these countries. Even non-strategy RPGs like Final Fantasy 16 kind of got into that sometimes, where it's just like, okay, enough with the politics. I just want to go kill a big monster.
See, I love the politics. I'm totally there for all the political intrigue, but I think this one hit the balance by satisfying the people like me who are there for all the little politics and the, you know, the people stabbing each other in the back and the different political forces going at one another. But it was done in a way where you can still follow along. It's not so up its own, you know, whatever, that you're going to get lost in 14 different factions who are going at one another.
Yeah, that's my biggest complaint about, like, Final Fantasy Tactics is the politics run so deep in that game that it's pretty easy to get lost unless you're reading every single little thing in the in-game glossary. And yeah, that they kept it simple enough in this game that it was easy to follow and still managed to be intriguing.
And the pacing was great too. Like, I never felt like any of the cutscenes were too long or anything.
Reason why it feels different is because they made it more personal. It's not that there's less of, you know, factions or less people that you want to defeat, things like that. It's because of the war council you have with those seven characters, which honestly, I wanted everyone to be in the war council. Give everyone a chip. Like, have 29 people come up and to make the decision that way, personally. But even having the seven didn't deter in any way, shape, or form. Those main core group of characters always had something to bring to the table in a personal manner. So instead of just thinking, you know, Hyzant is just Hyzant, you know, it's the, you know, a country that's over there and they do religious stuff. You have two characters that have religious backgrounds. You have two characters that hate half the people there. You have someone persecuted by the people there. So everyone has a different viewpoint to make it a personal decision.
Yeah, I agree. The way they wrote the characters in this game was just nothing short of amazing. My only real complaint is maybe I could have done with a little bit more levity. Though some of that was more in some of the characters' side stories. Like, yeah. I remember one of them where another character wanted to get the Frost Mage drunk, and he just was kind of being a stiff about it the whole time. I do remember that. Ryan, before the show, you said that you had a hot take about this game. Have you said that yet?
I have not said it yet. We have not reached it. If you like, I can. We haven't brought up this part of the game yet. I can just mention the hot take first, if you'd like.
No, go ahead. Just because I'm curious now.
The music is Final Fantasy Tactics bargain version. There's no real good song in this game. They all just remind me of Tactics, but worse versions.
I mean, to be honest, the music really didn't stand out to me for the most part, so I neither agree nor disagree.
There's a few bangers, that's about it. Most of it is serviceable, but it doesn't really... There's not a lot of songs other than the theme song that I remember from this game.
No Octopath Traveler.
It led to one of my first moments, because as a reviewer, I don't really... It took a little while for me to find my voice on how to talk about music. And I had written the review, and I didn't really have much to say about it. And we got a comment on the site where they said the soundtrack is amazing, and how little it's talked about is criminally misleading. Mm-kay. And I went, okay, am I missing something? And then on my lunch break at work, I listened for 30 minutes to the 10 songs of the soundtrack, and then went up, finished my break. By the time I made it up front, I could not tell you a single song from the soundtrack. And it was just that forgettable. And then I just immediately started thinking Final Fantasy Tactics again. So
I don't think there's anything bad. There's nothing in here that was annoying or bad. It's just, it does its job and that's it.
Yeah. And there's so many, you guys seem to be agreeing. I thought there'd be someone that would say, this is an amazing soundtrack in some way, shape, or form, because it generally is regarded as a really good soundtrack. And I just, there was one song I ended up liking, and that's just because there's nothing like it in other tactical RPGs, and that's the Travis and that Trish's song, because it's just kind of like, the Turk song coming out of nowhere in Final Fantasy VII, where it just breaks immersion almost. But yeah, that was because this game, I gave it a very high score. It was the first game I ever gave this high of a score to. It's, I love it to death pretty much, but I listened to half the soundtrack tonight trying to think of stuff, and I went, I don't remember any of this.
I mean, typically when I have a game soundtrack I like, it's because I'll be playing and then all of a sudden I'll be like, hey, this song's kind of a banger. And for me, mediocre soundtracks are just the music is neither annoying me nor moving me.
And I guess along that same note, the voice acting's just entertaining, but I don't think it means to be.
My memory is that it was uneven, but this is one that was kind of where a lot of the recording probably was happened, COVID likely interrupted the development and localization of this one. So I kind of assumed that led to some of the unevenness in the direction and performance of some of the characters.
What language did you guys listen in?
English. Never bothered me.
English.
I'm odd in that I'm so used to video games. There weren't really a choice when it first came out. You could play English or Japanese. So to me, video games are English. So no matter what game it is, I don't listen to it in Japanese. It just, there's something about it that doesn't really work. It's kind of for anime, I can't listen to Dragon Ball Z as in Japanese because it was on my Saturday morning cartoons.
My preference is most certainly English. If I'm listening to a game in a Japanese that has an English option, it's because the English is terrible. See Star Ocean 4. I had to switch it to Japanese because I couldn't stand some of the voice acting in it.
Oh, that child character in that game still haunts my memories.
Oh.
Right. She was terrible on Japanese too, though, so I don't know if that helped, but...
Yeah, he was pretty terrible in Japanese, but at least I couldn't understand the terribleness, so it wasn't as annoying.
Fractional improvement. I couldn't understand how terrible it was.
Yeah. So yeah, there's that. So if I'm listening to a game in English, it's because it has a decent cast. I didn't really notice any of the uneven voice acting or anything like that.
I did, just because of like going back and looking at the responses, there were some lines that were delivered very wooden.
Yeah, like that's my memory too. There would just be there were certain characters that were worse than others. There were just certain points in the game where you're just like, that sounded like that needed another take. That was just completely flat. That didn't kind of fit the overall scene.
And Benedict always felt flat to me.
Yeah. And like I said, like, you know, they were recording that probably during lockdown of COVID. So, you know, they were adapting on the fly. That certainly didn't help.
Yeah, I think that whole period of games, you might have to give voice acting a little bit of a pass for that limitation.
Very true.
Well, unless we have anything else to contribute, I do believe we're ready for the roundtable. Oh, I forgot to do the prices. I know that on Steam, well, hang on, let me just look it up. When I was Googling it earlier, I saw some people asking, is this game a good game for $12 on Steam? And I'm like, yes, that's a steal for this game.
And while you're looking that up, I just want to reiterate how much Scales of Conviction is just an amazing concept overall. It is such a brilliant way to try bringing out a bonding system without actually having bonding points, because someone can still disagree with you, but you're swaying their emotion for it. And if they built upon that by having things like almost a Telltale Games version of they will remember that,
mm-hmm.
or like you convinced me to do this, I'm going to remember that next time, so it's harder to do it next time. There's just so many ways that this could branch out. And for me, who loves dialogue in the way that I do, there's just so many story options that play out from something as simple as just characters coming up with a chip and putting it in. It's just brilliant.
So it looks like on both Steam and the Nintendo Store, the game is still $60. But I know that Squeenix has sales all the time where this goes on sale for $30, and I think it goes even lower on Steam. And as far as used copies, you can get it for probably as cheap as $20 or $30 for the Switch version. I am genuinely surprised that this hasn't gotten ported to, like, PlayStation or Xbox yet. Because I know, well, I'm pretty sure Octopath did.
Yeah.
At least the first late, game. Though,
didn't it? Yeah, it did.
So, yeah. I'd say it's a pretty good game for $30. I paid full price for it back in the day, and I got my money's worth.
It's like 30 is as low as it's gotten on Steam so far, at least here in the U.S.
Okay. And and it's Steam Deck verified. So there you go. And I think the council has agreed this is a good game. You should definitely play it.
Buy it.
Mm-hmm. I'm also surprised we haven't heard rumblings of a sequel, but they just did the sequel to Octopath 2. They're currently using the engine to do a remake of the Dragon Quest games. Who knows?
I think there are rumors of something they're working on that people think is a sequel to this, but yeah, obviously nothing confirmed.
One of the things here is, because Square did make it, but there was an unknown amount of help from a company called Artdink. Yeah. And I don't know what else they've been working on. It does look like Dragon Art Quest Dink 3.
Has mostly been known for like doing train simulators in Japan.
Yeah, that's why I didn't bring them up.
Very weird history. So it was the same producer as Bravely Default, but the staff underneath was Artdink, not... who was it that did Bravely Default? Kel, do you remember?
Oh, gosh. I had
the studio? I forget.
Who did Bravely Default? The guy is Tomio Asano.
Yeah.
But it... Silicon Studio.
There we go.
Yeah, that was kind of a weird. Silicon Studio has some weird releases. Like they did Operation Darkness, 3D Dot Game Heroes, and their last game was Terra Battle 2. But then they were also kind of second party developers for Square, and they've done Nier and Dragon Quest XI and like Hellblade and stuff. So kind of an interesting development history there with Silicon Studio. But anyway, I think we're ready for the round table.
Just one quick interesting thing about Artlink is they did the PlayStation versions of Ogre Battle and Tactics Ogre as well. So even though they did train games for a decade and a half in between, they do have Square tactical RPG DNA in them. Yes. Sorry.
No worries. Let's have a brief musical interlude, and then we'll be back with our personal thoughts. So we'll be right back. Welcome back to RPG Backtrack, where we are getting into the roundtable, talking about our personal feelings about triangle strategy. My first question, as always, did you guys have a favorite moment from the game?
Ooh, we kind of already discussed it, that first big battle in Chapter 7 against Journal of Vora, where you have to kind of decide, like, oh man, am I going to burn down the village to save the village? Yeah. Such a great battle, so brutal and gut-wrenching to do it. But at least on my playthrough, like, I didn't have any choice. That was the only way I was going to beat her. I just had to burn the sucker down. And it was so much fun just trying to... Like I said, it's kind of like a different sort of strategy battle than you would normally have. Rather than trying to just, like, clear the way all the way across a map, instead you're just trying to lure her into the little traps. Like, okay, I've got to kind of do this fighting retreat and manage to get her next to one of the buildings so I could spring the trap and do huge amounts of damage to her.
See, for me, it ended up being Frederica's "let my people go" moment, and that one fight I was talking about at the goddess statue, where she broke the statue and it had a pillar of salt on the inside, and then you're fighting on this platform surrounded by water where I'm lightninging enemies. That was just a great moment. If you guys ever replay the game, you need to do Frederica's Path, because I loved her. It was for my next question.
I think that was the path I was attempting to go down, and I just kind of made too many, like, what I thought were pragmatic choices, and then got locked out of it.
Yeah.
Because I get to something, I'm like, I think I really need to decide with this to win this next battle, and then it's, you know, kind of get locked out. Which is kind of the neat thing about the whole system, you know?
Yeah. You're not necessarily making choices, you're just going on along with the ride and trying to make the right choices.
And that's what I'll end up saying is my favorite moment of the game, is that first time you have your full party and do the Scales of Conviction, when it isn't just necessarily the tutorial version where things are blocked up, because each choice and how it affects how that person is swayed for that decision, how it affects future decisions, how it affects mood, you get extra, just the whole conviction overall is just, it blew my mind and opened up so many possibilities that it's the one thing I make sure I take from triangle strategy.
Mm-hmm. I would go with the burn down the village part as well. Just like the fact, once you realize that, like, hey, this is optional, and what are the consequences if I actually do this? Like, that's not something you usually see in the game. It's just like, oh, this is the plan. We're going to have to burn down the village. And then it just kind of just happens. Like, to see it there and for it to be like, you know, this is a choice. it's an option, and then going through the battle, and you know, if you do it, seeing how hard the battle is, even that, in, with the fact that you're doing it, it's like it kind of sets the tone for the whole game. And I can't think of a lot of strategy RPGs that do anything like that. It's an amazing moment.
It's the tactical version of the Luca Blight fight, really.
Yes. Oh my God, the Luca Blight fight. Oh God, that fight. That's a whole different tangent, though. And I'm not going to say anything more.
I cannot wait to re-experience those two games coming up.
Same.
We might have to put a backtrack on schedule next year so that we can both play them and refresh our memories on them. But I digress. That being said, who were you guys' favorite characters?
I loved Frederica.
She was my favorite too. You know, they could have easily damseled and distressed her with her background and stuff, but the fact that they had her be very strong, and as she's finding out the stuff about her people and her past, she became very determined and more connected to them. It kind of got me a little bit, and that's why I did nothing but wanted to make her happy for that reason.
I totally agree. I think her story is very well done. And obviously, you could tell the one ending I did, I picked her path. So I think that says how I feel about it for sure.
Yeah, I really liked Federica. I think part of it, I also really like Benedict's story, which it may be because I kind of ended up on that ending. So I got a little bit of more of his backstory and the way he was kind of like all of the way he kind of manipulated everything to happen, at least along that pathway, about getting back at Lord Sinanoa and Lord Simon and King Regna and the way they had treated Lady Desta. And I was just like, oh wow, you really played the long game to kind of like make this come out the way you wanted. It's kind of an interesting way for it to end.
Who was yours, Ryan?
Other than, you know, Frederica's waifu, Serenoa being a great protagonist, Erador just being entertaining, but to go completely off the beaten path because it's the only time he's been mentioned so far, I loved Archibald, the old kind of blind archer. He seems to have been a part of everything in the history, because whenever something happens, you talk to him, he's like, yeah, I was there. And then he gives you background information on what was occurring, and like, dude, you survived all the wars. And then when you use him, he's just this amazing archer that, like, if you cross his field of vision, you're dead. So it was like having a Terminator old man. It was great.
You know, we didn't talk much about Serenoa, but I mean, he was a really good lead. It's so often in games where the lead just kind of ends up being, you know, like they so desperately want him to be kind of bland, blank slate, especially in one like this where there is actually where the story can twist and turn and move. And like he doesn't have the, you know, the strongest personality in the world, but like you get a real sense of who he is as a character. He's really likable, enjoyable character as well.
Yeah, I was really, really impressed with the way they handled him.
What I liked is usually they make the protagonist, like you're saying, a blank slate. Serenoa felt like he went all in on whatever the player chose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like he had four different personalities, basically. Like every route you go, he cares about 110%.
Yeah, he doesn't just feel like, no, it doesn't just feel like, you know, like the like a silent protagonist where you make choices and, you know, it never kind of feels like your character is anything. It feels like he really is becoming the character that, you know, you're making him to be with your choices.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that they did an excellent job with him, not just making him a bland piece of milquetoast that normal silent, not silent protagonist, but just normal protagonists like games like this tend to be. I enjoyed his character quite a bit.
The reason he's still in like a second or third place for me is because I picked Frederica's route and she's so amazing. He kind of becomes Frederica's husband. rather than Sarah Noah, the character. He's like, I love everything my wife does, and you just follow her decisions rather than having any agency for himself, really. And that, there's nothing wrong with that. Frederica is a great character, as we've all said. But that particular route, he does, he's very affectionate and loving his wife.
So, next I was going to ask what our favorite endings were, but it seemed like most of us only got one ending, except for me, who got two different endings, the Frederica one and the Golden Route. So I guess just tell me what you liked about your ending, because it didn't seem like you guys had a disappointing ending. Otherwise, you would have played the game again, I'd imagine.
I mean, I wasn't disappointed with my ending. I was heartbroken, but it was very well done. And I need to go back and play some of the other endings, because, you know, it's not just something you can just go and watch on YouTube. Like, there are whole other paths, and I want to see, like, all those moments for myself. So,
I mean, I do gotta say, getting the true ending where everybody is satisfied and everybody lives happily ever after is definitely satisfying. But I am curious, like, what goes wrong in those other ones, or how the other characters kind of get screwed, that the characters that you didn't go with. I know in like one of Frederica's, or rather, I know that in one of the endings, Frederica becomes a street preacher and shaves her head so that she's not obviously a Rosellian. And it's like, wow, kind of harsh.
Yeah, there's always the bad. I think pretty much all the endings have the not great ending for at least one of the characters. The Benedict ending, I got, you know, Sarah Noah became king, and Roland is the one who kind of goes off to be a monk helping the poor. But there's, you know, even though you become king, there's still, they straight up tell you, like, oh, there's still lots of racism against the Roselle, and there's the huge gap between the rich and the poor. And Roland is kind of already kind of talking about, like, well, it's about time to, like, get some revolution and overthrow. Kind of, like, ominously, like, oh, man, are you going to go to war with your old friend? Like, oh, geez. Once again, bummer ending.
So, just so we have something else to talk about as well, I only had one actual ending. I don't often have time to replay full games, but there's a character ending that has a couple of different options that, based off of how their character was done, I was very happy I got. And that's the Princess Cordelia, because she reminded me so much of, like, the tragic, just being used princess that was made famous in tactical RPGs by Ophelia and Final Fantasy Tactics, that I was fully expecting her to be injured or die. And there's a couple of different choices on how you go approach the castle that she happens to be in, that if you do one particular route, she joins your party and gets basically a happy ending after being a political pawn for the entire game. And I was happy I got that. Because the other option, she gets injured or doesn't know that her brother survived. Like, there's just aspects where she dies not knowing and just is a pawn the whole time. And I like that I got her to reunite with her family and to join.
Yeah, as much as I say that they did a good job with Frederica not damseling her, they kind of put all that energy into Cordelia, which makes me a little bit sad, but I'm glad that at least she gets one good ending.
It's the damsel is, depending on how it's written and how it was for Cordelia, is she didn't like, how is she supposed to be able to fight when Roland wasn't there, her brother and father die? And it's like, if you don't marry me, I'm gonna kill you. Like, that's a damsel, yes, but there, it takes a different type of strength to still have dignity and poise while being the damsel.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave her that agency, and you could still have entirely different ending that doesn't affect her survival, because it's only that particular map that changes it, which is also very interesting and a whole different way of experiencing the game at times. Is some of the chapters you go to will just change that chapter. Like, there are some characters that stay dead that would otherwise come back, or have moments where in one route they're an enemy, while in another they're your friend. Like, It's just great poetic.
Yep. And then my final question. Did everybody say what they liked about their ending?
It made me sad. I guess I liked it. It made me sad.
I was happy bummed.
It's bittersweet because Frederica and the Roselia do kind of get a happy ending. Well, okay, I guess she doesn't get a completely happy. The Roselians get a happy ending. There you go.
Sarah Noah does not.
Yes, because he's dead.
So that being said, my final question, did you guys have any memories associated with this game at all?
Well, my memory is with you, Kel.
Yeah, like, yeah.
You and me and Andy all playing this at the same time and like swapping notes on like, what happened when you picked this way? Oh, I picked this other option. What does that do? You know, like all the texting back and forth over like what, you know, like swapping notes on what all the different decisions and all the different little strategies for the game and how to get past that first tough battle in chapter 7. What did you do? Did you burn it down? You know, all that fun stuff. You know, it's always fun to actually like be playing the big game at the same time as everybody else, especially one like this where there's so many branching paths. Even if they don't truly branch in a way that you're going to get something totally different, still to be able to kind of like talk that through and see how that works was so much fun.
Yeah, that was going to be my memory too, because I think I sided with Frederica, you sided with Benedict, and Andy sided with Roland.
Yeah.
So the fact that all three of us ended up on vastly different paths naturally, it was just so fun. And then us kind of combining notes on the getting the true ending, which apparently only I had time to do. I don't know about Andy.
I think Andy did. I think Andy came back and did a second playthrough to do the true.
But yeah, that's always so fun. Like, what chapter are you on? How did you handle that fight? That kind of stuff. I look forward to stuff like that. It kind of helps me justify spending $60 on a game brand new when I could play it with my friends. What about you, Ryan and Wheels?
I kind of said mine already, and that was being an idiot and saying, oh, this is a lighter, less dark Tactics Ogre, and then on Q&A quest, and then basically having to eat crow for weeks and weeks as game events in the game got darker and darker.
They fooled you.
Yes.
I think the game is still significantly less dark than Final Fantasy Tactics.
Oh, in Tactics Ogre. The first decision in Tactics Ogre. Tactics Ogre.
Oh, yeah. It still
pretty
haunts me.
Freaking brutal.
Another one where there is no real good choice. Yes. They're both awful.
Now, Kirby from Tactics Ogre, my one wish for this game would be if you could just go straight to the branching points and not have to do a complete new game plus.
That was such a great thing that they added to the later games, the being able to just like jump around and do that.
Yeah, maybe in this game's second or third remake.
Now, granted, you can blow through some of those initial fights in Triangle Strategy on a new game plus, and if you're skipping the cutscenes, since you've already watched them, you can get to the different branching points pretty quick. But that one at the end, I just want to go to that one spot and try all the paths without having to play through the entire game four times. I mean, the chart's right there. But anyway, Ryan, did you say yours?
Not yet. I will give the choice. Do you guys want to hear the melancholy one first? That's just a little I wish aspect.
Well, let's get out the scales.
Yeah, pretty much.
You'll need to convince one of us. No, I'm teasing. go ahead. Do the melancholy.
Melancholy sad aspect is I'm a very social gamer, and possibly based on the timing I got it or because it was too early to know everybody, hearing you guys mentioning, oh, we all played it together and talked about decisions, and I'm like, I would have loved that so much. I didn't get to talk about any aspect of this game until today. So
that's the crappy thing about reviewing it. Or well, like, it can be worse if you know, you get halfway through the game and then you're stuck and then nobody else has played it.
I've had a few of those where I was translating Japanese websites trying to figure out like some strategy to get past things.
On the flip side of that, it is the first time in a while and last games like since where I didn't try to optimize a route. I went what makes sense for the character and story, and whatever ending I got, I got. I didn't like, I would have been cool if I got the golden ending. I did try thinking of how I could make that work, because I assume there was at least two endings. I didn't know until the end, because there nothing was out yet at the time. So when you have that choice about are you going to upset this person and join with them, I like that came out of nowhere because I had no idea. And being able to experience a game so fresh that you don't have that inkling to go, well, how do I make it the most? Do I need to use this character? Do I need to beat this? It didn't happen as much in this, but a game that's a perfect example of that for me is like a Persona. Anything with a social bond system where it's like, oh, if you don't maximize the route, it's almost like you have to play the game twice. But if you take that option out because you don't know how to maximize yet, it just gives a sense of freedom that's very fun.
I mean, I think that's the way these games are really designed to be played too, is just play it organically and, you know, see where it takes you.
Yeah.
It pains me to see so many people like obsess over like maxing all the social links or like trying to get everything instead of just play it. Just play the game.
Yeah, when I play a game like this for the first time, I'm always like, I'm going to play naturally. I'm going to let things go lie where they lie, and anything else is, and then the new game plus is where I try to direct myself towards an ending or a conclusion that I want. And playing it that way, I eliminate so much stress, you know, wondering if I'm gonna, if this decision is gonna screw me over, or do I have to go find a guide, or there isn't a guide, so I just have to hope this isn't gonna screw me over. I feel like playing games for me it, that way just eliminates so much stress.
Totally agree.
That's how I played Baldur's Gate 3, trying to live with my decisions and not get a specific outcome. There was one recently that I played this year, and I'm blanking on it, but you guys know what I mean. And I mean, if you would have maxed out all the social links the first time playing through a game, you do you. That's fine. It's just for me.
If that brings you joy, then go for it. But I see too many people like playing through it like that, like it's a job.
Yeah.
And
no, I can't. I don't like doing that the first time through a game. It stresses me out too bad.
I end up having so many games I'm interested in, backlog being so big, games I've never tried, that I don't know I can think of doing a second route. So that's where the feeling of missing out aspect comes in. And if I picked up Triangle Strategy like last year, for example, I would have done the golden route just because that encompasses the most of the game. But that also means I probably would have had a guide up and I would have followed, oh, I need to do this at this time. I need to make sure I win the fight that way. And that takes something away from the organic storytelling aspect. But that's, I don't know, I'm just going to watch a video on all the other routes. And it was the first time I'd made that decision. And it has been freeing for other games I play in the future, because you play something with, like Baldur's Gate 3 you mentioned. If I wanted to do every single thing that's possible in that game, I'm probably never playing another video game again. So you just pick your route and you stick with your options and go from there.
I almost wish they would take the golden route out of these games. Actually, you know what? I'm going to take that back. Developers, remove your golden routes. Make us feel pain.
So they need to have an anti-golden route, where it's just, yeah, you know how you like, wanted something to work? Nothing worked.
Yes.
I mean, I call that the Benedict route, but
I call that the trying to kill all the kids in Fuga 2 route, and it being even harder than just playing through naturally.
I'm the person that when you delete a generic unit in a game and it says, are you sure you won't want me to be here? What's wrong with you? And I'm like, no, I want you to stay generic person number two.
Jean-Eric, you're my favorite member of this party.
Yeah, it's the only time you ever spoke to me is being sad I'm getting rid of you.
Oh, I think we're ready to call it a show. You just made me realize that Baldur's Gate 3 is going to qualify for Backtrack next year. That's going to be an interesting one. Mm. That'll definitely have to be an R-rated one, though. That's for sure. But regardless, I think our next show is going to be Xenoblade Chronicles 3. We've got some scheduling woes with one member being sick and stuff. So if we have another show that isn't Xenoblade, don't be surprised. But we'll work that out off air. No worries. The next show could be either Xenoblade or Surprise. That being said, thank you, Josh and Ryan and Wheels, for hanging out with me tonight.
Mm-hmm. It was a pleasure.
He had to bail, but thank you, Matt, for editing and being my co-host. I could not do this without you. And of course, thank you to the listener for hanging out with us for Triangle Strategy. If you're curious about this game, I would definitely pick it up. It's a really fun strategy RPG, and to be honest, I think it's a good, not only is it a good beginner strategy RPG because of the lack of stress with min-maxing, I also think it's a good one if you've kind of fallen off the genre and want to come back to it without much of a headache. I don't know if you guys would agree with that or not.
Absolutely. Especially with the difficulty selection.
Yeah.
You put it on easy, ease yourself into the genre, or if you're an old hat, put it on hard and you will challenge yourself a lot.
good game. Hope they do a sequel. And that being said, thank you, listeners. We will catch you in a pair of weeks. Have a good rest of your week, and we'll talk to you later.